Human Services Committee hearing for Wednesday, April 27th. We do have a long agenda today. Our thought is that we will be recessing and reconvening later this evening. The agenda says 5:30, but our time change right now is probably 6 p.m.
Body art.
So we'll do what we can get done here this morning and then recess until 6 p.m., not 5:30, as the agenda says. So just a note. And the first bill on the docket today, Senate File 1120, Senator Nino, and if you are ready, Senator, please.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1120 is an agency bill, and Mr. Chair, I know I've mentioned this to you previously, and 1120 is, it's pretty big. It was 100 pages long or something like that. I've actually sat down with the agency staff and went through page by page to make sure I know what's in the bill, but and so I know what's in there, but I don't necessarily remember it all because this was a few weeks ago. So I'm going to let the staff go through this section by section, page by page, and they would be better equipped than I to answer questions, but certainly if there are any questions for me, I'm more than willing to try to answer those, but you may get a little more robust answer from the staff.
All right, thank you. Senator, you know, and who would like to begin?
Yeah. And actually, Mr. Chair, there is an amendment here. We have the A2 amendment. This is some technical corrections that I don't know if this has been handed. This has not been handed out, I don't believe.
We do not have the amendment distributed. We will get that distributed. Have you got the copy of it so that you can?
I do have a copy, yes. And Mr. Chair, this is mostly some technical changes. There are, for lack of a better word, some substantive changes here. But let me just give you high level overview here. We've got technical changes, some clarifications. supports the delay in implementing the agency requirements related to assessors, removes where DHS has agreed to continue with working with stakeholders. There's some stakeholders that didn't have concerns with some of the language but didn't have full comfort with some of the language. And so the department, in a show of good faith, has agreed to pull some of that language out of the Senate bill. They're also working through that on the House side so that there's placeholder language. But just to show good faith to the stakeholders that they're not trying to pull something over on them, pulling some language out of this bill to try to get full comfort. Like I said, not that they were concerned. They just didn't feel fully comfortable yet. There's a clarification on effective start date for waivered services for some recipients, and it clarifies the provision of case management under prepaid health plans. So it's mostly technical in nature. There are a couple of substantive deletions, but that really is just because there's some work on language and getting everybody comfortable, and that's what's in the A2 amendment.
All right. Sir, you know, is the we've got a summary that's been prepared by the department that says the bill as amended. So is the summary assuming we adopt the amendment? Is that correct?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Nino has offered as an author's amendment the A2 amendment. Any questions on the A2 amendment? See none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted and the bill as amended is before us. Senator Nino, who would you like to testify?
Now, Mr. Chair, there is one other amendment that I will offer up, and I will let the committee decide what they want to do with this, but I did agree to offer up. This is the A3 amendment.
Sir, you know, is this another author's amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, kind of custom in usage, we get one mulligan here with author's amendments and get the bill in the shape we want it. And like I said, I will let the committee decide what they want to do with this amendment. I don't know that it's particularly controversial, but I don't know that it's completely non-controversial. And so put this forward for the committee's consideration. I'm just going to read a little background here, and I don't know if we have someone that wants to speak to this. I'm just going to read this here. In prior years, the legislature enacted a provision that placed certain requirements on personal care assistants, PCAs, PCA agencies. One of the requirements was that the PCA agency provide an annual report, basically certifying that 72.5% of revenue generated from medical assistance was going into PCA wages and benefits. At the time, the agencies thought shouldn't be a problem, but there are some additional overhead costs that kind of come into play here, and there's been at least one instance and probably more where there was some concern with hitting that actual number, and I see Kevin Goodnow here at the table. I won't go into more detail on that. And what it amounted to really was reducing overhead or trying to bump up some salaries to make that meet, and it created some incentives that seemed to be maybe counterproductive. And I'll let Mr. Goodnow speak more to that in some more detail.
All right, thank Kevin you. And Commissioner, I guess, former Commissioner Goodnow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Nino. My name is Kevin Goodnow. I represent the Minnesota Home Care Association, and we represent a number of agencies that are personal care assistant agencies. And Senator Nino was good enough to offer this amendment. This was an initiative that was, this requirement was put into place a couple of years ago when we put a number of requirements in place for personal care assistants and personal care assistant agencies. I tried to talk to Senator Laurie this morning just to give him a heads up that this was coming. He was the author of that bill a couple of years ago. At the time, there was this intent to put this requirement so the wages, the amount of the rate that was paid to the for on behalf of a PCA service, that 72.5% of it had to go to wages and benefits for that individual PCA. At the time, we thought that that was manageable and doable, but within the bill, there was requirements that the agencies also get surety bonds, fidelity bonds, and also a fair amount of paperwork that all are related to overhead costs that would come out of in the overhead. And so what's resulted is a number of the agencies that didn't think they were going to have a problem are actually foreseeing a problem and meeting, you know, that threshold. What they've done in response is not increase the wages but actually reduce overhead costs. In one case, we had a provider in northeastern Minnesota that had a remote office location to serve people in a more remote area. They had a qualified professional who's a nurse that manages the PCAs that were run out of that office and office staff in that agency. They actually shut the office down to reduce their overhead costs to meet that threshold. With the inflationary costs going up, without rates going up at the same time or likely to be reduced, although it may have been a good idea a couple years ago with the current economic environment, the 72.5% requirement is very problematic, I think, for personal care assistance agencies. It may have an impact on access to care in greater Minnesota in particular. So we'd appreciate your support. And I know there is opposition. I know there are people that supported this in the past. So it's not a non-controversial amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Laurie.
I did get a note at my office that you did stop by, and I appreciate that. But I am curious as to, you know, why. I mean, it's the morning of the presentation of this bill. I mean, if there were issues with this, it would have been very convenient for members that have had a stake in this in the past to have gotten some heads up before, you know, literally 30 seconds ago I sat down, and this is the first I've heard of concerns with this provision that was put in law 2 years ago. So I that is troubling to me. I do plan on voting against this amendment for that reason. I'm interested in hearing more about these concerns and issues, but this is not a particularly good way to approach something that, you know, I'm told has been a problem, I guess.
Senator Hans, or Mr. Chairman, Senator Laurie, I appreciate that. You might want to we did have a meeting earlier at the beginning of session, and this was mentioned at that meeting, that there was a concern about it and that we would be looking at this and likely when we went through with the policy bill. So part of what we were looking at was, I have been talking to folks and letting folks know, especially in the advocates. Well, I let some folks know that we were looking at this. This remained a concern for us. It's been a concern from day one for us, actually. So, you know, I guess I know you have to do what you got to do. So I appreciate that.
Mr. Goodnow, just a question. I understand the argument that having this fixed number, and given that there have not been a lot of revenues out there to increase the resources available to the agency. So they're solving the problem by reducing their, I guess, their costs, which may result in not having as broad services available. I understand that. Is there a, do you know if there is a number instead of 72.5 that is currently being hit by the agencies or would be? I mean, what are we talking about here? If we're saying we're not going to hit 72.5, what is the practical effect? Does it go down to 50% or what? You know,
Mr. Chairman, it's a good question. there's a philosophical issue about should that requirement be in law to begin with. Notwithstanding that whole concern, when I ask folks what is a comfortable number to shoot for, what would be, you know, workable if they were to change the number that I heard was 62.5% to 65%. Now, that could vary depending upon what happens this legislative session. For example, the House is carrying a provision in their bill that reduces the personal care assistants who are relative caregivers by 20%. And if you get a 20% hit in that, that cascades down and really then the 65% probably isn't even realistic. And the result would be the reaction. I mean, sometimes the goal is good, but the reaction is different than what people are trying to achieve.
And I don't want to speak for Senator Laurie. He's, I'm sure, more familiar on this than I am. But my guess is that the intent of this originally was to make sure that the bulk of the funds that went to the program were being dispersed as salaries and benefits to the people providing the care. Having this provision go away, I guess it does open up the possibility, well, then where does the money go, and is it really being used to provide care? And that's why I'm just curious about what does that translate to as a practical effect?
Mr. Chairman, the couple of responses. I think the genesis for this provision or this idea came from a number of years ago when there was concerns that when there were rate increases for the Medicaid system, that those rates weren't being passed on to the workers, and the providers used the workers a lot to lobby the legislators for those rate increases. And so there was encumbrance language that came that said a certain percentage of that rate increase had to go to workers. When the rates started to be reduced in recent years, that encumbrance language was lifted and actually forgiven because they were reducing the rates at that point. The issue here is that this would be the PCA agencies are the only agencies under medical assistance where they have this type of requirement. So I guess to the extent there's a question about where does the money go, the same question would be applicable to anybody that receives Medicaid. So I mean, not a great answer, but that's the answer.
Senator Sherrin.
Thank you, and thank you for that, because that's my memory as well and continues to be my concern, that as there would be lobbying for, on the basis that the cost of living adjustment had not occurred for the PCAs or others who are working in agencies, and we would do rate increases on that argument, and then the agencies use that for other purposes, and then would say to their employees, we can't do anything better because you need to get to the legislature and ask them for more money, which they would do, and then the same thing would happen. And what this does, I think, it takes away any safeguards there are that that's not the phenomena that happens. Because what the solution is to the problem, which I accept exists for your industry, is it's just like higher ed, where, you know, are you going to pass it on to the students or where are you going to shift the costs? And what you're asking for here is that it gets shifted again back on to the employees, that they are the ones that then we put at jeopardy or at risk when and if we do rate increases, or that they're the ones that end up paying the consequences for the failure of this legislature to raise revenue for your industry. And that's the problem that I have, not the problem that you're describing, which is that your costs are right, going up, and you're trying to figure out a solution to that.
Are there other questions? Senator Ninal has offered the A3 amendment. Senator Ninal, any final comments? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, like I said, I didn't include it as an author's amendment because it's not particularly controversial, but it's not, as we've seen in the discussion, it's not non-controversial. Personally, you know, I can I could argue both sides of this. I tend to lean towards the side that says that the government shouldn't be specifying particular percentages. We should, those whom we're contracting with, essentially, we should be able to allow them to run their business as they see appropriate. So I tend to lean that way, which is why I offered the amendment. If I was completely opposed to it, I wouldn't have offered it. But I understand that there are two sides to the issue, and there are work concerns. And so I'm just leaving this to the committee's decision. Do you want to have this included in the bill or not? I mean, I'll vote for it because I offered the amendment. But
can I ask the representative of the department any position on this amendment as part of the bill?
Mr. Chair, we're neutral. There's no position.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, or any of the other members, had there been a full hearing on this bill in last year, the year before? Or is this the first time we were? Yeah.
No.
Senator Newman, I am not have not been at a hearing where this bill or this idea was brought forward, and I don't know if there others have.
Mr. Chair, and I didn't mean this year. I meant whether there was a full vetting of this issue in a prior session. And my concern is that we now are faced with an amendment with little or no information. That's just a question on my part.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
to Senator Newman, are you talking about the bill itself or the amendment?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Newman.
The amendment.
The amendment. I think Mr. Goodnow did describe the history of the amendment quite well in his presentation, that this was part of a larger package of PCA reforms a couple of years ago, and it did receive a good deal of discussion, but was an agreement that was not met with a great deal of resistance from the provider community. They thought that they could live with this at the time. Apparently, there's been some problems with it. But, yeah, we did have conversations about it. It was discussed and fully discussed during the committee process and put into law, I think, 2 years ago. And, again, Mr. Goodnow did do justice to describing the procedure that we went through to get this into law.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, I'll admit, and I appreciate the fact that this is not the ideal way to go through with the process, and it was an issue that we've had a concern about. As we've seen some various proposals that have come through the legislature in the more recent time, I think the intensity around this issue has increased, and that's why, we decided to pursue it at this point, and so I apologize we didn't get it in sooner as far as the bill and have the full discussion. If there are other ways to accommodate, if the language hasn't been included in the House side, and so if this isn't the right way to address this issue, and there's other ways to do it, we're certainly willing to discuss with people that have concerns about it. If there are other ways to address this bill goes forward, it's not at all from our perspective take it or leave it. We just want to address the concerns that are out there. So, we allow for access to folks that are out there providing services.
Just on that vein, Mr. Chair, this bill does, if this amendment goes on, whether this amendment goes on or not, but if this amendment goes on, this bill does have to move through one other committee and obviously would have to come up onto the floor as well. So if there are concerns with completely removing the language and maybe it should be tweaked a little bit, obviously I'm open to looking at that and reworking it. And, I don't know if I call you Commissioner, Representative, Mr.
I've been called this about everything, Mr. Senator.
And Kevin Goodnow here has indicated that this is not a take it or leave it. They're open to it. So clearly, as it goes forward, this is something that it can be revisited. That I'm certainly not opposed to that as the author to do that. And I'll make that comment to the committee as well.
It's my understanding that this bill would, if it passes, would be referred to Energy, Utilities, and Telecom. So apparently there would be another stop for this bill if there were other concerns and could be addressed then. But Senator Sherry.
Yes, I would like to respond to the hearing on this particular change. There has not been a thorough discussion of its implications. In Senator Lurie's original bill, because it was in a different environment, we were doing rate increases, which is a different environment. So the dialogue around that and the agreement to this language that's being deleted here was not resisted. But since then, we've been dealing with a great deal of deficit and reductions or the lack of rate increases. And so as those pressures occur on everybody, everybody's looking for some way to solve their problem. This is my perspective, of course. And the way to solve the problem, I think, is not this way. I think it's a problem, and I think it needs a resolution. But the solution that this amendment is asking us to consider without really letting the PCA community come here and talk to us or all the people that would be impacted by this is to have them be the ones that pay the price for the deficit. It's not that there aren't going to be consequences either way, but I don't think it's fair to come to a committee and put an amendment of this magnitude on a bill without allowing people to come and talk about its implications. I agree with that.
Other questions, comments? All right. We have an amendment before us, the A3 amendment. Senator Nenow moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Thank you.
The amendment fails.
And, thank you, members.
Perhaps if there's another opportunity to address the concern, I appreciate the concern, so we can hopefully try to find some agreement. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, now we can move on to the substance of the bill. And I presume we'll start with Article 1. Article 1 is, I believe, the section that needs us to, or is going to require us to stop through another committee later in the week here. I guess I'll let staff do their thing. They're better at it than I am.
Senator, you know, I didn't have a clue what you just said.
Short version is, I'll let staff tell you.
Thank you.
I know yesterday when we were in hearing and also in the Education Committee, the microphone that's on my right doesn't seem to work. And so all I would encourage the presenters is maybe to use the other microphone exclusively and pass it among yourselves. That one does seem to pick up the voice, but that one doesn't. Maybe it's fixed today. I don't know, but that was what it was doing yesterday. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Sarah Maheswaran. I work for the Department of Human Services, Equipment, or Telephone.
Could you just repeat your name one more time?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'm Sarah Maheswaran.
Maheswaran.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome. I work for the Department of Human Services Telephone Equipment Distribution Program. And the purpose of the TED program is to provide telecommunication equipment to eligible Minnesotans who have a hearing loss, speech, or a physical disability that prevents them from using a standard telephone. The program provides the telecommunication equipment on a long-term basis and does not pay for the monthly telephone service cost. There are also income guidelines to qualify for the program, and I'm going to be referring to the background information here. Okay, so there's three proposed changes to the TED statute, and they fall into three categories. One are technical changes, and there is a amendment that I believe you received related to the deaf-blind definition. That's part of the technical changes. So we're proposing to change the word impaired to disability, using first-person language communication device to telecommunication device. So there's some outdated language that we're wanting to update. There's also some Minnesota Relay language changes as well. The second type of change is policy change, and there are two main changes here. Three. We're basically wanting to establish, we've added that the Department of Human Services can establish policies for the return of equipment when clients are no longer eligible. And this would help us become more cost-effective, because sometimes it's not cost-effective to be receiving this equipment that could be outdated. The second change is to remove that the Department of Human Services doesn't have to pay for outside wiring. Our current statute states that they would have to, but with the increase of wireless towers and most houses now have the wiring line outside their home, so we are proposing to remove that. And lastly, we're just clarifying that any relay user can file a complaint with the telecommunication provider. And the last change that we're proposing is program purpose clarifications. So we're basically wanting to clarify that we provide assessments to all our clients to determine what equipment they need. And that's what we've been doing all along. We just wanted to clarify that in statute. And secondly, we've added language called functional equivalence, which is parallel to the Department of Commerce's terminology. So we wanted to represent that there. Thank you.
Thank you. And that is Article 1?
Correct. Correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Why don't we just see if there are any questions on Article 1 before we continue? Any questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, thank you for your presentation. And Senator Eno, do you have someone who's going to present Article 2?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll pass the microphone over here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lori Dablo. I work for the Department of Human Services, the Disability Services Division, and I will be covering most of the changes in Article 2. To start with, the community residential setting license, this is in Sections 1, 2, 28, and 24. There's two changes here. The first one is to give the commissioner the authority to indicate on a license whether the foster care license is a corporate foster care license or a family foster care license. This will help us to track the corporate foster care license and is consistent with changes from 2009 that required a moratorium on corporate foster care licenses. The second change is just to bring the community residential setting license as a component of the quality outcome standards. Section 3 covers family support grant. The change here will restrict families from receiving the family support grant at the same time they're receiving one of four home and community-based waiver services for people with disabilities. It also would restrict them from receiving personal care assistant or consumer support grant services at the same time as family support grant. We project that the impact of this will affect less than 150 of the 1,800 family support grant participants, and that this will allow about those 150 new participants from the waiting list of over 1,000 to be able to access family support grant. Sections 4, 26, 29, and 31 refer to a biennial report. We currently have three separate reports that are required. Two are required annually, one is required on a biannual basis, and we're proposing to combine that into one biannual report that will include all of the overarching goals of the disability services area and include status updates on all of the programs. There is also some waiver waiting list data that is usually provided in the annual reports, and our plan is to put that online so that people can access that more frequently. Section 32 covers the home and community-based services waiver programs rate setting and provider standards. This language that we're proposing just begins to operationalize legislation from 2009 that gave the department authority to develop common rate setting methodologies and provider standards across all of the waivers for people with disability. For the past 18 months, we have been engaged with stakeholders and will continue to do so. Section 14 covers a change in guardianship, public guardianship. The proposed change would eliminate the quarterly reporting requirement, would allow the department in future rulemaking to streamline the reporting requirements with case management and other reports and reduce paperwork. Section 15 is the consumer support grant. The changes here are just updating the language so that it reflects the changes from 2009, the PCA authorization process changes. And lastly, sections 16 through 25 are proposed changes to the PCA program or PCA language that are necessary to fully implement the changes from 2009 and 2010 legislative session. These changes will reduce inconsistencies and clarify current policies. Thank you.
And that, Ms. Dablo, is the Article 2 summary. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it concludes all but one item in Article 2.
Before you leave us here for a moment, could you just go back to Section 32 that you... The home and community-based service rate waivers, and you're describing this as things that are needed to bring us in conformance with what federal law requires. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. In 2007, when we were engaged in our renewal for one of our waiver programs, the federal government determined that we were out of compliance with two areas. So we brought forward language to the legislature in 2009 requesting authority to move forward with the rate setting project across all of our waiver service programs, all the disability waiver programs, and provider standards. So there were two projects that we began at that time.
And so, Ms. Babel, I guess it's unclear to me what exactly we're doing. The federal government is requiring us to do something differently than what we're currently doing. Could you describe the difference between what we're currently doing and what we have to do under the federal law?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the federal government found us out of compliance with 2 out of 7 assurances that we're required to assure them while we operate the waiver program, and one of those assurances had to do with rate setting, that we needed to have consistent statewide rate setting methodologies. We were found to be out of compliance because we have relied on counties to negotiate rates. The second issue was that we required counties to contract with providers, and in that contracting process, they established additional provider standards. So both issues really come back to statewide consistency from the department who is responsible for the programs.
So just so I'm clear, Ms. Dablo, what the federal government is saying is that it's not permissible for Minnesota to delegate to counties the determination of what quality is or what the standards are, and so what the rates should be in negotiation with providers. Is that correct? That's not acceptable for us to allow for there to be a regional or county differences, that we have to have a statewide implementation, so sort of moving this all up to the state level. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. There needs to be that. The state needs to be establishing be administering the program and assuring consistency across the state and not having differences in counties, disparities or inconsistencies.
Can I ask you, as a spokesman for the department, what is the department's opinion, setting aside the federal expectation? Is it permissible in the department's view or a good policy in the department's view to allow there to be this level of authority at the county level, or is it better to have the decisions and the management be done at the state level? I mean, does the department have an opinion on the policy independent of what the federal government rule is?
Well, Mr. Chair, while they're formulating their right answer, I guess one inference we could make, and we'll see what they say, is that that's what was happening previously. And one could presume, anyway, that if the department thought that was a bad idea, they would have changed it without this outside impetus from the federal government. But now we'll get their answer.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think we do agree with the consistency is a good goal to achieve. It does really lend itself to people, the consumers, making better choices, and if they move from one county to the other and they want to have the same services and there's different rates, it can affect. I mean, there's a lot of complexity to it, so I think the consistency is a very positive thing.
Is there a cost element in this? In other words, to do this all at the state level, is there an extra burden, an oversight or cost or something that has to be absorbed by the department that previously was being that activity being done at the county level? If you understand my question, are we going to assume some additional overhead costs as a result of centralizing the decision-making on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I do believe there are some. As we centralize things, there are some additional resources that are needed at the state level.
Thank you, and I appreciate your clarification of that. I'm just trying to understand the effect of complying with the federal rules and also trying to understand how reasonable they may be. I know we have a bias to follow the federal rules, and I understand that for lots of reasons, but I think it's fair for us to examine what they're asking us to do and how reasonable we think it may be and if there are costs attendant to that. I personally think that there are problems with that structure, but I'm just trying to understand as we go forward when we see these things to understand what the impact of that is. So I appreciate your willingness to talk about that. So you had said now there are some other Article 2 issues that need to be presented by...
Before you move on, may I speak?
Sorry, so sure.
Thank you very much. For a minute there, I was thinking that you were beginning to say that there are times when centralizing and systematizing on a larger basis makes more sense than simply across-the-board assumption that local and individualized county control is a good idea. But you modified that towards the end. And I would have been silent if you hadn't done the modification, but I do want to say that in this discussion that I do think that there are things you gain and lose depending on how small the system operates something, what's the right size, where its location. It's a fair debate. But I think that in this case, after some initial readjustment costs, there may be, in this instance, a better reasoning why the federal government would say centralize it, because people move county to county and you get services in one place and not in another and it's different, and all the explanations that those local social workers have to go through to try to explain why they do it differently here and there. Sometimes it makes sense to have some consistency on a statewide basis, and sometimes it's better to do it on a smaller basis. So I just wanted to add that to this general conversation.
And Senator Sharon, I agree with you completely. I am not taking a dogmatic position saying it's always better when I just am trying to understand what those trade-offs are. I agree with you that sometimes
okay.
it may
I'm
make
with
sense,
you there.
But sometimes it doesn't. And one of the concerns I have generally is that as you raise the or centralize decision making and something isn't working well, it becomes progressively more difficult to make changes. And that's part of what I'm interested in is as we do these things, recognizing we're talking about people and serving people and that there are differences that you have to account for. And if you have to try to manage those differences by going back to the legislature or to the federal government, that's problematic. So I'm just trying to understand what the dynamic is here. And one other question before we leave this, I guess. You mentioned that there probably would be some attendant costs. Is this something that needs to be in the budget portion of our bill then if there are costs associated with this change?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are still evaluating those and planning to come back next year to inform the legislature of the kind of the finalization of how we operationalize this.
So at this point, you're saying that we don't have any costs identified, but you're suspicious that there may be as we make this change? Is that
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. I think that we are going to be working with stakeholders and kind of pinning down how we will operationalize the rate setting and provider standards and then be able to come back.
Is it fair for us to assume that whatever costs we may see in the next year would be just absorbed by the department so that there would not be a need for a fiscal note at this point? Or
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure I can answer that would be the case.
Senator Bergen.
Mr. Chairman, I think in this case, one of the things that will be positive that comes out of this is that there will be more common rates across the state. And from a provider's perspective, you know, most providers don't just serve people in one county. They serve people in multiple counties. And when you have a different rate for the same thing, you know, in five counties that you're providing services to, it is very, it adds a lot of administrative burden, and it is sometimes difficult to figure out, you know, exactly how many clients you're going to have in each county with a different rate. So I think, you know, this is probably a move in the direction of simplifying our system, and there will probably be a little adjustment by providers because there'll have to be some averaging of those rates, but in the end I think it probably is a good thing.
Senator Rosen, I apologize. I know you had asked a question. So.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dabno, if we could just go back to the very first part of Article 2. You mentioned, if you can just refresh our memory back in 09, what was the reasoning behind a moratorium on corporate foster care? If you could refresh our memory.
Ms. Dabno.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the moratorium was established in 2009. It was part of a budget reduction or budget savings proposal because the residential services for corporate foster care were a higher cost than other alternative arrangements under the waivered services.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
And Ms. Dabno, and that is still the case? They are still higher costs, the corporate? Existing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that moratorium, we are continuing that for that reason.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions before we turn it over to, is it Ms. Hamilton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Disability Services Division at the Department of Human Services. I just have one section in Article 2 to talk about, and it's Section 35 related to streamlining consumer-directed services. Currently, Minnesota offers several consumer-directed options through waiver programs and also state grant programs, and there are also other options that are available through the federal government or that will be available soon. And what this section does is requires the commissioner to provide recommendations on how to streamline the administrative oversight, financial management, and payment protocols for the current options that are available and any future options that may become available. And it requires the department to come back next January with recommendations on how we would implement those changes.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Hamilton? Seeing none, thank you for your information. And we're going to start with Article 3.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pam Urkel. I work with the Disability Services Division at the Department of Human Services. Article 3 is around case management and comprehensive assessment. The background on this is that in 2009, the legislature authorized the department to develop and implement a new assessment process and standards. What we're doing is we're taking four different assessment processes and paper-based tools that we currently have and combining them into one, and we're developing a web-based application and service planning process in order to determine people's eligibility for long-term care services in general, and that includes for home and community-based waivers as well as state plan home care of PCA and private duty nursing, as well as some of our other state grant programs. The next piece is case management. Back in this past 2010 legislature required the department to consult with stakeholders regarding making some changes in our case management system. Our case management system can be very complicated. And so some of the changes that we're making here are related to that as well. In sections 1, 2, and 4, the changes that are currently in the bill are impacted by the A2 amendment. We were removing that language in sections 1, 2, and 4. Sections 3, personal care assistance services assessments. This is moving us towards the direction of implementing the comprehensive assessment. PCA services assessment will become part of the comprehensive assessment process. While we're doing that, we do need the authority to continue with the way we're doing assessments currently. In sections 5 through 11, this is in long-term care consultation. This is where the Minnesota Choices Comprehensive Assessment will be defining the administrative roles of what the assessment process will do. We're defining the assessment requirements and what programs are included. We're defining the roles of a certified assessor. We're defining a community support plan and what's necessary to be included in that support plan, and what people who are being assessed will be receiving after the assessment is completed in terms of that community support plan and assessment summary. In sections 16 through 17 of the bill is really where we're removing the language around defining case management as a service. rather than right now the case management is combined administrative functions and service functions, and what we're doing with these changes that we're making are separating the administrative functions from the service of case management in general. Currently, counties and tribes and lead agencies are responsible for case management, and there are some administrative functions such as determining eligibility for services within that administrative function. So we want to really define what that is and what the service of care coordination or case management is. In Section 38 of the bill, we are also eliminating personal care assistance services as an excluded time services for purposes of determining county of financial responsibility. This was a discussion that we had in our case management work group in terms of county of financial responsibility. We'll be doing some more work around this discussion. But it was felt that eliminating personal care assistance services as an excluded time service would be helpful and a step in the right direction for helping to determine or make some changes in county financial responsibility policies. And then finally, in Section 39, we are recommending that there continue to be the work of the Case Management Reform Group, so that we can continue the work that we started in the summer and fall and come back for other with other proposals around case management.
Thank you, Ms. Circle. Are there questions?
Yes, Senator Hahn.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'm on page 47 of the bill. You have deleted some language that says the assessors must be a part of a multidisciplinary team. Professionals that include public health nurses, social workers, and other professionals. Could you talk about that change and why that's a good idea and what we lose in the process of eliminating that assessment?
Yes,
Senator Hahn, Senator Sharon, members of the committee, that language is deleted in that section because it's moved to another place in the bill.
Thank you.
In a more appropriate place in the bill.
Thank you.
Are there other questions on Article 3? Seeing none, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Hild from the Department of Human Services Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division, and I will describe briefly Article 4. Article 4 addresses three different areas, moratorium-related, the publicly owned nursing facilities provisions, and case mix. It starts on page 75 of the bill. With the hardship areas provision of the moratorium law. And what this is doing is providing more workable criteria for the situation where there's a county or other defined area of the state with serious access problems for nursing home services. It also lays out a new process for addressing hardship areas and permitting beds to be added in those areas, nursing home beds to be added in those areas. Another area of the moratorium law that's addressed here has to do with bed relocations. These are already permitted and subject to a fairly simple criteria that the department is to apply, having to do with budget neutrality. This takes the current process that we've been using and developing for a number of years as we've processed these types of requests and puts them into law, making the application more consistent and transparent, and continuing to ensure that the bed relocations are budget neutral to the state. The third area of the moratorium law that's addressed has to do with the criteria to be considered when a moratorium exception process is being undertaken. And this was, repeals the prior criteria and creates a new list of criteria, making them more up-to-date, more clear, and pulling them all together, putting them in one place. The second topic addressed here is in Sections 6 and 12, having to do with the publicly owned nursing facilities, a program that allows a non-state local governmental entity to supplement payments to a nursing home and receive federal match on those payments. And that was enacted last year. This makes a number of amendments to that law. It adjusts the time frames for the implementation because we're still awaiting federal approval, although we do expect that to be granted shortly. It allows the program of federal matching to continue after the completion of the phase-in of rebasing using the upper payment limit test, so that if a local government entity wants, this is a voluntary program, if they want to continue to supplement the nursing facility, they'll be able to continue to get federal match within that set of limits. The current law says that participation, while voluntary, is irrevocable. The irrevocability is taken out of the law. And in addition, rather than requiring application to be completed by September 30th of 10, makes that an annual possibility so that a facility or an owner could revoke their participation and then reapply to be back in the program. We furthermore delete some unnecessary language, correct a cross-reference, and finally, the language addresses the issue of what the commissioner should do if the local governmental entity does not make their contribution of the non-federal share by saying rather than withholding them that we would revoke their participation.
Senator Hahn. Oh, here.
Senator Sharon.
Would it be appropriate for me to ask a question on this section right now?
Sure, absolutely.
Could you talk about, I see that you have some impacts of the proposed change here, but I think that I've heard some concerns from private nursing facilities that cannot participate in this, feeling as though this is creating an unfair competitive environment for them. If they're in a community where there is a publicly owned facility and then a privately held facility, have you heard any conversations or discussions, or do you have any data to say whether or not that you've been discovering those concerns or complaints as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I have not had anybody approach me with that concern. I understand what it is, and I can understand how that could come about. I think that there are a lot of arguments that could be posed as to why the program overall would be unfair to non-governmentally owned facilities, because these facilities are owned by somebody that has taxing authority, can use the taxing authority to supplement the resources of the facility. In a similar way, over half of our nursing facilities are owned and operated by not-for-profit organizations that can receive tax-deductible donations. And so I think that an argument could be posed either way. I'm not trying to take away from their argument, but I think it there's other facilities that have similar advantages.
Thank you. And that may be something I might be looking at in the future.
That's a good point. I appreciate that. And Mr. Hill, did you have more that you wanted to present on Article 4?
The last topic I was going to talk about was in Sections 7 through 11, and that's the case mix transition. This is being driven by the change of the federally mandated assessment instrument, the MDS 2.0, which was replaced last October 1st with the MDS 3.0. It's an assessment instrument that is supposed to provide greater accuracy and require less resources to complete, according to studies that were done on it. That change will force the state to reconsider how it does the case mix classifications that we do. And in this part of the bill, what we're proposing is that we move from the current classification system called Resource Utilization Groups 3, a federally designed system that we have chosen to use, to RUGS 4, Resource Utilization Groups version 4, a 48-group version of the classification, and use the CMS determined, federally determined indices or weights to go along with that. Further, this makes that change effective on January 1st of 2012, and it specifies the method of the transition to RUGS.
And Mr. Hill, just a similar question to what I was asking the previous testifier. I'm assuming there's some cost to do this. Are those costs going to be borne by the department, or is this, again, something that's going to end up in a finance bill? And if so, maybe it shouldn't be before us right now. But are there costs associated with this transition?
Mr. Chair, I believe that there will be some minimal costs having to do with reprogramming systems to handle the new classification system. The departments have anticipated that for several years now. Money was set aside a couple years ago to cover those costs. And as a policy bill, this does not have a fiscal note. We have not assigned costs to this. Conceivably, without this, there could be costs to facilities or to the state because of the new classification, the new indices. The formula that we've put in here is designed to make that budget neutral or revenue neutral for each individual facility, and we've concluded that it would therefore be revenue neutral and cost neutral to the state.
And what is the virtue of the new indices the federal government is requiring? You mentioned the impact that the proposed changes are necessary to enable us to continue to make accurate payments. Does that mean that we're not making accurate payments, or we're in danger of not being able to make accurate? I mean, what? I guess I'm trying to understand, again, from the department's perspective, the value of these changes, or is it just we're doing it because we have to? I understand that. But independent of that, is there a compelling need to do this change from a standpoint of the services that you're providing and the way that's being done?
Mr. Chair, I think there's a compelling need in a couple ways. We could continue to use the prior categorization or classification system. However, the MDS-3 doesn't give us all the data elements to do that. And so in order to continue to do that, we would need to require facilities to provide us additional data elements. In other words, we would have to add more paperwork to the system without really getting a real benefit from doing so.
But aren't those additional data elements being required by federal rule? And again, is there a necessity to have additional data elements to do what you're doing?
Mr. Chair, to continue to do it the way we do it today, we would need data elements that are not in the new assessment. They were in the old assessment and were removed. They were changed.
I'm not sure if I'm clear on that yet, but I'll consider that. And again, I'm just trying to understand what we're doing, not saying that we shouldn't do it.
To get to the issue of the accuracy, Mr. Chair, the federal government has provided what they call a crosswalk that takes us from the new assessment to the old classification system. We don't feel that that would be a good solution to use on a permanent basis, but it is the only solution that we have until we can work through the transition period.
One other question, I guess, going back to earlier Section 3, you're talking about changes in the nursing home moratorium, hardship provisions, bed relocation provisions, I guess that's another section. But and then you've got some changes, criteria for review that is different. How many requests for exceptions to the moratorium do you have to deal with every year?
Mr. Chair, we only deal with exceptions to the moratorium when the legislature appropriates funding to approve those. The moratorium not only applies to adding new beds to the system, but it also applies to major capital improvements. And periodically, most recently, I believe it was not the current biennium, but the prior biennium, the legislature did appropriate money and an authority to the Commissioner of Health to undertake a moratorium exception process. When that happens, the number of proposals that are received and the number that are approved will depend on how much money has been appropriated for that process. During the 8-9 biennium, I believe there was $2 million appropriated, and there were somewhere in the range of 20 proposals that had to be considered for approval.
Other questions? Thank you. I understand there's one other article in the bill.
Mr. Chair, Article 5 is the revisor's changes. These are technical changes. There's a couple of paragraphs that have been deleted because they're obsolete, made by some repealed language. And then there were some citations that were changed, or that were updated due to some changes. So it's all purely technical in Article 5, and that's what the revisor said should be done, I guess. So there's not much there in Article 5, just to keep it all in order. Mr. Chair, well, first of all, I want to thank the department staff for their time here, but more so for sitting in my office for a couple of hours going through this page by page when I made them do that. I'm sure they would have liked to go home early that day instead of sitting in my office, but I like to know what's in the bills that I carry. So if we don't have any more discussion, Mr. Chair, then I'd move the bill. This has to go to Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunications. I guess I'd move. We recommend a pass and send it over there.
Senator Eno has moved Senate File 1120 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunication. Are there questions on the motion? Questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The bill is referred. Thank you, Senator Eno.
Thank you.
And thank you, members of the department. Appreciate you being here today to provide us some assistance on understanding the bill. Senator Benson, are you ready for Senate File
1173?
Senator Benson, welcome. Whenever you are ready, you can begin the testimony. Do you have an author's amendment that you need to adopt initially?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I believe I have the working microphone.
You do.
I'll do this right now. We have the A1. I'd like to present it as an author's amendment.
All right, members, let's adopt the A1 amendment. I'm going to assume that the information we have summarized in the bill assumes the adoption of that amendment. Is that correct? So we don't need to review the amendment separately, I guess I'm getting it.
The as I see from Senate counsel, she did advise on the amendment as well.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the summary summarizes the bill, not the amendment.
Not the amendment? Okay.
I have so do we have somebody prepared to talk about the amendment? Why don't we just the motion is before us. Maybe you could just review briefly what the amendment does, and then we'll adopt it.
Sure.
Please bring the microphone close. Identify yourself.
Oh, okay. I'm Christine Borsheim. I'm at the Minnesota Department of Human Services, Division Director for Child Safety and Permanency. I have a summary of the amendment in front of me here. The first amendment is for the juvenile treatment screening team. The provisions for this is for this team to conduct screenings within 15 days of a request, and that the team shall include a parent, guardian, or permanent legal custodian when that's appropriate. There's a number of other technical reference changes to adoption assistance provisions, some corrections, citations, and cross-references for child abuse, the CAPTA requirements, which is the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, particularly regarding registration of predatory offender. It makes an amendment for the definition of American Indian child to mean a person under the age of 21, and it adds Article 4, which are provisions covering child support. It clarifies existing laws regarding exclusions from adoption assistance eligibility. We'll actually cover that a little bit more in the bill summary. Clarifies by cross-references that placement preferences and consideration of placement factors applies to preference for adoption when adoption is in the child's best interest. It clarifies provisions for determining parentage and adds cross-references to Minnesota Parentage Act. It clarifies that the information already required to be provided to relatives and that relatives also be given information that they have the right to ask the court for notice of hearings about the child. It clarifies child's rights to be heard, present evidence, and cross-examine witnesses at hearings. It clarifies the agency's ongoing efforts to engage with relatives who are known or come to the attention of the agency. It clarifies provisions for court findings regarding engagement with relatives. It clarifies court findings regarding agency's efforts to place children with relatives and provisions for court review no later than 3 months of the agency's efforts, and they review agency's efforts to engage with relatives who are known or come to the attention of the agency.
It strengthens and clarifies provisions for diligent and comprehensive relative search practices, including that the relative search must fulfill agency duty for active efforts required under Indian Child Welfare Act, age-appropriate engagement with children to identify relatives, and a definition of what constitutes relatives' participation in the care and planning, and relatives' right to request notice, attend, and be heard by the court in permanency proceedings. It strengthens language regarding provisions for maintaining sibling relationships, clarifies training curriculum for prospective, adoptive, and foster parents, provisions for judicial review of termination of foster care for children between the ages of 18 and 21, required provisions for notifying of adoptive and birth, adoptive child and birth parent death. They change that age from age 19 to age 18, and provides for the agency to counsel adoptive parents regarding benefits of communication or contact agreements to serve the child's best interests.
And that is the A1 amendment.
That is the A1 amendment.
Are there questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Benson moves as an author's amendment the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The bill as amended is before us. Senator Benson, how do you want to proceed?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill has three parts. The first and third part directly relate to the work of this committee. The second part relates to the work of the Judiciary Committee. So we'll be focusing on parts one and three. And I'm going to let the agency who did the substantial material work on this document talk us through section one as we begin. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Borshon, please continue.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a summary. This child welfare policy bill is about streamlining and aligning mostly existing child welfare provisions across safety, foster care, and adoption program areas. It makes administration of our programs more efficient and transparent, ensures compliance with federal regulations to maintain stable funding and avoid fiscal penalty, and ensures that our policies support rather than create barriers to achieving positive outcomes for kids and families. And most importantly, it includes provisions for moving kids out of foster care and into families through adoption whenever possible, and through physical and legal custody with the relatives when it's in their best interest. Much of what is presented in this bill is not new requirements or policy for agencies, county or tribal agencies, or courts, but in a number of cases, we've reordered, renumbered, and reorganized new chapters of statute in order to provide a more seamless path to permanency. I will point out as we go through it those areas where there is new policy direction and the reasons behind that. As Senator Benson mentioned, I will be covering mostly Article 1 and 3. There are a few provisions in Article 2 that we'll be covering also. The first article covers the administration of the Adoption Assistance Program. The bill essentially creates a new chapter, which is 259A. It puts all administrative procedures in one place. It'll make it, the administration of this program, more user-friendly and transparent. There are not substantive policy changes. Many of the changes respond to findings from fiscal audits of this program and our own reviews of the program to improve administrative procedures. The second article relates to the reform of the Juvenile Court Act in Chapter 260C for children alleged to be in need of protection or services for whom the county agency must petition for permanent placement and for the adoption of children under state guardianship. This article is also largely about organizing statutes so the content and application are in a more logical and legally appropriate sequence. It moves adoptions for children under state guardianship from Chapter 259 to Chapter 260C. To support a seamless pathway to permanency. It does include some substantive policy changes, and again, there's a few of those that we'll talk about this morning, not most of them. And it also includes provisions for complying with federal regulations under Fostering Connections Act. The third article of the bill largely contains conforming or technical language based on the rest of the bill, and there are some new provisions related to child safety. My intent is to walk through just a kind of a section-by-section summary, if that is what you would like. Under Article 1, the first section adds and amends definitions specific to adoption assistance. Section 2 is program administration. There are limited substantive changes in this section, but it does direct the commissioner to establish procedures to implement the program rather than promulgating rule. This will allow us to keep operating procedures and administrative procedures up to date more easily. Section 3 is about eligibility requirements for adoption assistance. Adoption assistance is a program that is intended to support adoptions of special needs kids, kids who are under state guardianship. Without that assistance, they would remain in foster care. It simplifies the eligibility criteria, also helps us meet federal requirements under both fostering connections and Title IV-E. And there's also clarifications that the state does not assume financial obligation for children where the financial responsibility of another entity. Section 4 is about establishing adoption assistance eligibility. Basically just replaces some terminology and some terms that were confusing. Section 5 relates to benefits and payments under adoption assistance. Again, there's limited substantive change from current statute. There are some minimal changes in our non-medical expense reimbursements for kids who are under adoption assistance and require additional child care. That will now be limited to children 12 and under, up to age 13 and 14 under special circumstance. And we follow our own child care assistance programs to administer that. It also eliminates the reimbursement for birth to three developmental disability services because these are services are available through other funding sources and don't need to be funded under adoption assistance. Section 6 is about determining adoption assistance benefits and payments. Again, this just clears up some confusing language and helps conform with federal regulation. Under Section 7, there's reporting responsibilities. And there's the reporting responsibilities of the parent receiving adoption assistance. It adds some, kind of strengthens the language so that adoption assistance parents are clear what the consequences are if they fail to report. Under Section 8 is about terminating provisions for terminating the adoption assistance agreement. Section 9 covers the assignment of adoption assistance agreement. That assignment is now only permitted upon the death of an adoptive parent. Section 10 covers the extension of adoption assistance agreement. Again, this is extending up to age 21, which helps us comply with federal law. Section 11 covers overpayments of adoption assistance. No substantive changes in that section. The same with Section 12 that covers appeals and fair hearings. Section 13 is actually deleted as part of the amendment that we just heard. Section 14 covers the Interstate Compact on Adoption and Medical Assistance. There's no substantive changes there, but it does clarify difference between adoption assistance covered by 4E and non-4E, and also helps us come into compliance with some other federal regulations. Section 15, no substantive changes, covers reimbursement of non-recurring adoption expense. And Section 16 covers reimbursement of certain agency costs and purchase of service contracts, actually kind of tightening up our administration of purchase of service. It eliminates those contracts for services when they can be met through other resources that are available to counties and tribes. And it also helps tighten up some fiscal accountability matters under adoption assistance.
Before you continue, are there any questions on Article 1 of the bill? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry I didn't catch your name.
Christine Borsheim.
I can't hear it.
Christine Borsheim.
Ms. Borsheim, thank you. As you were going along, you said that there were some significant changes, but you just kind of went right past them. Are you going to go back at some point and tell us about those significant changes?
The significant,
Ms. Borsheim.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins. The substantive changes that I mentioned in my overview were not part of this article. They will be part of Article 3.
So, Ms. Borsheim, so the significant policy changes occur in Article 3, not in Article 1, is that
right?
Correct?
And, Mr. Chair, Ms. Borsheim, could you pull your microphone right up close to you, please? I'm really struggling with this door going open and shut all the time. I apologize. I just can't hear worth a darn.
Thank you. And this is a – we've got three doors that get used quite a lot, and the noise is a little – so
I understand.
To help us, I appreciate it.
Okay.
Other questions before we continue? Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Borsheim, as you went through Article 1, the gist of the testimony that I got from you was that there aren't any significant changes, and yet Article 1 appears to me to be all new language. And I have to candidly say that this is the first time that I've seen this bill this morning, and we are going through it quite rapidly. And so I'm going. At least to some extent, I'm going to be looking towards Senator Benson to give us some guidance here, because with all new language consisting of 22 pages, I'm not so sure that these are insignificant changes to an area involving adoption assistance, which candidly is a pretty important area, I would think. So I'm just kind of questioning what's going on here in terms of the speed with which we are going through this and the presentation.
Ms. Borsheim, would you care to respond to this?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman. And I can slow down my presentation on the upcoming articles. This does appear as all new language because what we have done is take all of the adoption assistant language out of Chapter 259, and we've created a new chapter that contains just the adoption assistance provisions, 259A.
So, Ms. Borsheim, is it accurate to say that all these pieces that are new language exist in the virtually identical format in another section of statute that is being repealed later in the bill? Is that correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair. Yes, that is correct. Essentially the same language. Yes, thank you. The rule and procedure will also be repealed. The changes were the ones that I did mention if there were some clarifications in some of the terminology, but it's essentially the same language move to a new chapter that covers just adoption assistance.
And so is the repealer in the back of the bill that would repeal these?
Mr. Chair, I believe 22? The repealer is in Article 3.
Article 3, Section 22, it refers to a number of statutes and rules, and some, I think on page 111 of the bill, is that the section that contains all of this language?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Senator Newman, are you at this point satisfied with the...
I wonder, Mr. Chair, if Mr. or Ms. Borsheim, can you then, if this is essentially the same language, and please pardon me, but could you go back into Article 1 and point out for us the changes, that those items which were not previously enacted?
Ms. Borsheim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, yes, I'll go back through the Article 1 where there are changes. Section 1 includes, of course, the definitions that are necessary to set out the new chapter. Under Section 2.
Borsheim, are all those definitions new definitions?
No, they're old. Look at AFDC, is in
there. Mr. Chair, no, they're not new definitions.
I think what Senator Newman is asking for is if you could point out in the first article places that, although it all looks like new language, what you're saying is it's not because it's existing in other parts of the statutes. However, there are some parts that are brand new. If you could just highlight the parts that don't exist in current statute that are new,
sure.
I think that's what Senator Newman, if I'm understanding the question, is asking. If you could highlight that.
Okay.
We don't have to review the whole article, just the parts that don't exist in statute today.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. In Section 2, one of the changes is that it clarifies the duties of the commissioner to establish procedures to implement the program rather than promulgating rule. Currently, under adoption assistance, the administration of that is there's some provisions in statute, there's some provisions in administrative rule and other operating procedures. The administration of the program will now be done by, like I said, under these new duties, establishing procedures to administer the program. That will help us keep more up to date year to year. If there's federal changes that we need to respond to, we'll be able to make those updates in our operating procedures versus having to make them statutorily or an administrative rule.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Newman.
Ms. Borsham, the section and subdivision or line and page that you're referring to, please.
That is subdivision.
Section 2.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, that is subdivision 3 under section 2.
Page 5.
So subdivision 3 under section 2 on page 5 is new language that gives the commissioner the duty or the power to specify, and this would then relieve certain things from having to be brought into the legislature to be dealt with in statute. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I have a kind of a goofy question, but I see in here references to AFDC, and I didn't think we had an AFDC program anymore. I thought it had been replaced by MFIP and, you know, other things from, like, much more recent.
Ms. Borsheim?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Higgins, Title 4E eligibility is still attached to AFDC language, and you are correct in that there is no longer an AFDC program, but like I said, the Title 4E eligibility is still connected to that program.
And that's Senator federal, Higgins. Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, yes, that's a federal.
Well, that's interesting.
Ms. Borsheim, please continue. Show us where the next new section of Article 1 would be.
Under Section 3, Subdivision 2 is a subdivision that helps us come into compliance with federal requirements. Subdivision 4 specifically precludes state-funded adoption assistance payments to person with a barrier crime. That helps us come into compliance with Title 4E. Subdivision 5 is clarifying language, requires non-federal financial portion of adoption assistance for non-Minnesota Indian child placed in Minnesota would be paid by the agency assuming financial responsibility. Again, that clarifies that the state does not assume financial obligations for children who are financial responsibility of another entity.
Okay. Ms. Borsheim, before you continue, and I don't know how many more new sections there are, but we do have to recess to go to session in a few minutes. I don't know if we're going to call yet, but we're not permitted to meet, I don't believe, while we're in session. Are there more new sections that can we complete that before we recess, or is there a lot of them?
Mr. Chair, there's not a lot.
There's not a lot.
No.
We can wrap it up in the next minute or two. I guess we could try, but please continue.
Under Section 4, we change the term high risk with at-risk child. That was a confusing term. This makes it clearer. This makes eligibility requirements clearer. Under Section 5... We have clarified.
Ms. Borsheim, yes. Senator Higgins, were you asking a question about that?
You changed what to what?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Borsheim.
Senator Higgins. Under Section 4 in Subdivision 1, the terminology that or the definition of high risk children is now at risk child. It was a confusing term. It implied something different. So this makes it clearer who is eligible and who is not eligible for adoption assistance.
And that's on line 10.3, I believe. Is that correct?
And is there a definition of that back here? Yes, there is. Okay. And then that matches that.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Under Section 5, we do have new limits on non-medical expense reimbursements for child care. We are now limiting child care reimbursements for children 12 or younger, and only upon exception for kids who are 13 or 14. And that's a change. Yeah. That's Section 5, Subdivision 4.
So Subdivision 4, which is on page bottom of page 11 over page 12, top of page 13. That's all new language. Subdivision 4.
All of 4 is new. Okay.
Chairman Hahn, the new language there is about the changes to the child care assistance, the child care reimbursements.
Could you give us page and line? Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Mr. Corchan, we're trying to locate the specific things that are new. You indicated the subdivision form. My question is if it's the entire subdivision or just pieces of it that are new.
It's on line 12.8 through 12.16. The change is that services to birth to three for developmental disabilities are no longer included in non-medical expense reimbursements because those services are covered by other funding sources.
Okay. Page and line on that.
Ms. Borsheim, do you have the line?
I'm trying to find the line.
Chair, I think it's eliminated, so it wouldn't show up in the language.
So counsel is saying that provision is part of the repealer, but it's not listed in the language. So it's in the repealer on section 22.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. Under section 16, Subdivision 2, it eliminates purchase of service contracts for services that can be provided through other sources available to serve the needs of the child. That is new. Mr. Chair, that appears to be on line 2234 under subdivision 3.
Okay. And I assume that's the end of the list of substantial changes. You have Senate Counsel just indicated that she's willing to provide the committee with a list of all these changes for our review by the time we reconvene at 6 p.m. if that's acceptable to the committee. I appreciate very much, Sir Higginson and Newman's question. And just for the department's understanding, when you have a whole body of what looks like new language, it does raise a few questions when it's described as not new, and so parts of it new, parts of it not new. If you can just clarify that for us, that would be helpful.
So, I understand, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I think we are done with Article 1, so we can reconvene at 6 p.m., and we'll start off with Article 2, although I know there may not be a lot in Article 2. But we are in recess until 6 p.m.
I just wonder where, because this is...
We'll also be in room 112.
No, but it's 112. That's okay. I must have pushed it over.